You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
All right, here we are. I'm Noah Smith. This is Ben Burgess, and I got that right, right?
Yes.
All right, and we're here to debate socialism versus neoliberalism again, but really we're going to be talking about presidential candidates and economic ideologies and, you know, how do we fix America and possibly the world. So
that sounds like it pretty much sums it up.
Right. Well, actually, you were the one who wanted this debate in the first place, I think, or someone else.
So actually what happened was somebody, and I've long since forgotten who, but someone on Twitter had seen me talk to the Twitch streamer Destiny, and he tagged you in a tweet and me and said, hey, you know, would you want to do like the socialism versus neoliberalism thing round two? And we both said, sure. And then I think we both forgot about it for months. And then I think I saw something else. I saw what you tweeted about Sanders' housing plan, and I like responded to that, and I said, "Hey, that reminds me, right? Weren't we going to do this?"
Right.
So, but then like we were talking about it, I think we talked about it. So one way we could do it is, which you know is not, I'm not totally averse to, right? Is just sort of relitigating some of the issues in the first one, because obviously those are big, interesting issues. But I think, but in my attempt to kind of find a way to narrow it down, I was suggesting since that we could frame it at least in terms of Sanders versus Warren, and I think the idea was that we would sort of understand that, you know, if in the natural course of the conversation it spills over into bigger issues about, you know, capitalism, socialism, life, the universe, and everything, that's fine, right?
But that sounds great. That sounds great.
We'll at least start with Sanders and Warren.
Right. All right. So yeah, I well, first of all, I think there, you know, Warren is very far from a neoliberal, and I was elected neoliberal shill by a goofy Twitter poll, and I served at that for 1 year before Matt Iglesias beat me for the title. But I was never really on board with a lot of what those guys like, and I was pissing them off constantly because I'm, you know, a big supporter of like industrial policy and unions and just a whole lot of things those guys don't really like. But I was also never I was never really fully on board with sort of the new socialism DSA idea package either. And so I'm just a kind of weird guy floating around outside. And then Warren came along and I was like, well, this is, I like this. You know, I mean, I had liked Elizabeth Warren from way back when she did the CFPB and other stuff that she had done, and just but then I saw some of her plans start to come out. I was like, wow, there was no real name for the kind of approach. I mean, New Dealism is really the name, but that's, people have forgotten what that means and don't talk about it anymore. And so, but that's kind of how I conceived of it. And that really, what she was saying really appealed to me.
Right. So, actually, because my first introduction to you came from somebody tweeting, hey, you know, do you want to do the socialism versus neoliberalism debate? I think actually one of the first things I had tweeted at you was said, hey, I'm looking over your timeline. I see a bunch of stuff about, you know, Elizabeth Warren. I think this undermines your credibility as a neoliberal shill.
It does,
right?
It does.
So I guess maybe one way of starting out is that, you know, I kind of talk about how I see the relationship between like socialism, Sandersism, neoliberalism, and Warrenism, right? You know, which are which seem like two, four separate things to me, right? So,
go for it.
A lot of, you know, so of course, neoliberalism is a contested word, and, you know, obviously anybody participating in the kind of poll that you're talking about sort of has this view that it's kind of a silly word, it's become meaningless. And I don't deny that it's overused in some context, but I think it's actually a pretty useful word to describe the revival, hence neo, of a more laissez-faire, hence liberalism, sort of way of doing capitalism, a less social democratic model. And in particular, the way that this revival has sort of filtered into traditionally left of center political parties. So, for example, there's a quote, I have no idea if it's, whether it's even real or not, but, you know, I've heard many people say this from Margaret Thatcher, when supposedly in her waning years she was asked to say what her greatest accomplishment was, and she said new labor, right? You know, that's the and that's the sort of idea that that she won the ideological battle so thoroughly that even her erstwhile opponents, you know, kind of saw the world in her way. And even if they still wanted to, like, reform the system in certain ways, they wanted to reform it in ways that would reflect a lot of those market-oriented assumptions. So, for example, when we talk about people like Obama or Clinton as neoliberal Democrats, a lot of that has to do with the idea that, well, okay, one, certainly in the Clinton era, there was still a lot of dismantling, right, of older sort of quasi-social democratic programs. And two, that to the extent that there was any attempt at sort of future reform, it tended to have these features like means testing, for example, instead of being universal, that reflected the kind of triumph of this wider market ideology. And as far as somebody like Elizabeth Warren, I'd say that Warren's political posture is somewhere in between that kind of Obama-Clinton neoliberalism and a social democratic ideology like you get from Bernie Sanders. And I think that even though I do suspect that the dynamics of running against Bernie Sanders in the competitive primary have dragged Warren to the left in some ways of where her natural instincts lie, I also don't doubt that her natural instincts are well to the left of Clintonism, right? You know, that they're much closer to that kind of old-fashioned, you know, Hubert Humphrey kind of New Deal liberalism than they are to kind of 90s and O's market-oriented, you know, right, democratic centrist politics.
I think that's right. Two things. Most of this characterization, I'd say, is pretty true. And you're exactly right when you said that the Clinton and Obama – those people, like, if you look at the people who call themselves neoliberal online, these are not, you know, libertarians. These are not Reaganites. These are not, sure, Cato Institute people. These are, you know, Clintonites and Obamaites, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, very, very technocratic. They want to do things with, you know, sort of programmatic redistribution and, you know, like, they and sometimes very wonky stuff, rather than, you know, sort of changing the basic shape of the economic system.
Right.
So, But I think you're right that Warren is not with them, and to the extent that I'm, you know, a Warrenite, neither am I. But also she's not with the Bernie people. But I think that the differences between those are not necessarily along a one-dimensional continuum, mm-hmm, because there's not just the question of whether government is, you know, bigger or smaller. There's several dimensions of what government does. So government can tax and redistribute. Right. Government can tax without the goal of redistribution just to reduce inequality. Government can regulate. Government can sort of nationalize and run industry directly. There's a number of different things that government can do. And government can work with other institutions like corporations in different ways. And one thing I see consistently from Warren is this idea of the idea that corporations produce a lot of economic value through their activity. Mm-hmm. And are pretty efficient at doing stuff. Not all corporations, but sure, this idea that they have to be harnessed not just by taxing them and redistributing the proceeds to people, but by actually changing the incentives, by strengthening unions, by creating new things like giving workers seats on boards. That's called co-determination. Mm-hmm. By sort of incentives to invest instead of return money to shareholders. Through, you know, long-term incentives for long-term investment, so basically dramatically limiting private equity in the financial sector, through incentives to export and to compete in world markets, and to which is a thing that's been very successful, for example, Germany. And so I think that this is not necessarily – I wouldn't necessarily characterize this as an intermediate step between Clintonism and Bernieism, but sort of a different idea of what government should do. And it is pretty New Dealist but not necessarily what FDR came into office trying to do, but what it eventually evolved into. And I think World War II was as big a, you know, a, a bigger piece of that evolution than the actual New Deal. And when we think of New Dealism, a lot of that came out of World War II. And we harnessed these giant corporations for war. And we created, you know, offices to invent new technologies and to get the government involved in research. And the war normalized the idea that it was okay for government to be heavily involved in the economy, but also the productivity of a lot of companies like GM was and IBM was very key to our war effort. And so I think that that impressed upon New Dealers' minds the idea that corporations are these engines of productivity that just need to be harnessed so they give, you know, like a good living wage and, you know, benefits and job security to workers and don't cause inequality and just distribute massive profits to shareholders and upper management. And I think that that we got away from that, of course, later on. But I think that that was sort of the idea of the New Deal. And I think that Japan and Germany took this farther than we did. You see Germany with their workers' councils and you know, basically sectoral bargaining and you see wage boards and things like that. Japan has – I could go on all day. But they have these systems like that. And I think that's kind of what Warren is thinking. I see some of the same stuff from Bernie. You know, there was that time when he wanted to tax corporations for – the government benefits that their workers used, which is basically saying, like, pay your workers. Don't make the government pay your workers.
Which is an interesting example, because I have to say I understand what he was trying to do there, but that's probably the Bernie policy proposal I'm least enthusiastic about, I think that in again, the underlying point is reasonable that these corporations are benefiting, you know, from government picking up some of the slack, you know, with these means-tested programs that their employees qualify for. But I think that if your politics are to a great extent based around big sweeping government programs, seen not as like an occasional safety net that sometimes people need, but as like a foundation for life, right? Then I think that anything that has the effect of kind of calling attention to or you know, unintentionally stigmatizing people for being recipients of government programs might be a miscalculation, right? That'd be my concern about that proposal. So I think that a lot of what you said is right. I think that you can say that of course, the sort of ideological self-understanding of a Warren is going to be different from either, you know, a Clintonite or, you know, or a Bernie-crat, although there are areas of overlap in both cases. Even if it does flatten some things a little bit, I do think that it is somewhat useful to think about these as a spectrum, because one way of kind of adjudicating the difference between a Sanders and a Warren is to think about, just think about what they have in common, right? And think about where their proposals tend to differ. So just two quick examples, and I'd love to hear your take on both of these, of how their concrete proposals differ. And one is about Medicare for All, and another one is about, well, the other sort of signature 2016 Bernie proposal about abolishing tuition at public universities, which is developed in 2020 into a proposal to also retroactively take away student debt. And so that second case, the difference is a little bit clearer, because I'm not 100% sure, actually, as I'm talking about this, I'm realizing that I'm not 100% sure exactly where Warren is at this point on the tuition half.
Let's talk about healthcare.
But I think
now, I thought that Warren had endorsed Bernie's plan for healthcare, and that was kind of the area where they differed least. I thought she just said yes, do that plan.
So it seems to me that she had some fairly ambiguous signals, especially when people asked her about this this question for a long time at the debates. She seemed totally unambiguous. She was saying that she was saying I'm with Bernie, right, on healthcare. Right. So yeah. That seemed straightforward. That seemed to settle it. But then one thing that was always very strange is that she was somebody who had a plan for everything, right? That's a big part of her branding, she has all these plans. But there wasn't really a lot about healthcare even on her website. And that lack was finally solved a couple weeks ago. And I will say that if you compare that to like what somebody like Bernie Sanders says, It's worryingly vague, right? You know, like the usual sort of what a part of the self-understanding of Warren supporters is often that, like, she has the details. This seemed much vaguer than what Bernie said. There's a lot in there. Doesn't really say explicitly whether, you know, copays and deductibles, for example, are being completely eliminated. It doesn't. There's a passage that makes it sound like mental health care would be entirely included, although there's some, you know, although again, it's cursory enough that you can read that in a couple different ways. And more recently, I'm sure you've seen there's been a little bit of buzz around the fact that she's answered questions about, you know, possible disruptions while getting there and stuff by saying, well, you know, it's a framework. We can kind of work things out, right? So all of that suggests to me, especially in combination with the fact that this wasn't really an issue that she was talking about before she decided to run for president, that this might be a place where the dynamics of the race have maybe pulled her a little bit to the left of her natural instincts, you know, which would certainly not be surprising. They've pulled a lot of people in the field to the left of, you know, of their, you know, like Kamala Harris is, you know, was saying for a while she was in favor of Medicare for all, and then she came out with a plan that that sounds way more like what Biden is proposing than what Bernie is proposing. Said you could have a public Medicare plan or a private Medicare plan. And so I think in that context, there's a little bit of worry and ambiguity about exactly where Warren is with this. And this maybe gets into a sort of bigger way of framing the difference, which is not about the concrete policy proposals, although I would like to talk a little bit more about that, but about how you're going to get there, right? What the sort of underlying theory of change is. And my view about that is that you're only like something like Medicare for all, you know, eliminating the private insurance industry is going to be such a huge battle, just given the realities of American politics and the power of the insurance industry, that I think even if Bernie Sanders is elected president, it's far from guaranteed that that's going to happen. But that the only way that there's like a chance of it happening is if you have really this kind of all out push that, you know, to prioritize it, that I think you're only going to have from somebody who's deeply, deeply committed to it. And I think I do see more evidence of that when it comes to Sanders than when it comes to Warren.
Right. So first, let's talk about healthcare. And yeah, in fact, here I'm actually going to agree with you. So healthcare is the worst thing about the American economy. I can't think of a single thing that's worse, not even housing, not education, nothing. Healthcare is the worst. It is just eating our whole economy. It is a nightmare. It is far worse than other countries that have been doing it successfully for decades. And it is the biggest pain point for most people when it comes to the current economic system, not wages, not anything else. It's healthcare. And Bernie has been well ahead of Warren and pretty much everyone else on this issue, on this central important issue. And I don't understand the politics well enough to tell if Bernie would be able to pass this plan or what that would require. Mm-hmm. I hung out with Ezra Klein the other day, and he went on a large sort of rant about this that I did not understand at all because I just haven't – I don't know. Sure. And – but I think that in terms of like exactly the optimal plan, that can be debated back and forth. And probably Bernie's plan wouldn't be at the very top of my list, but it would be a lot better than what we have now. And it's better than whatever Biden is serving up. And it's forceful and it's simple and it's something that people understand. And we need national health insurance of some sort. It's going to be national health insurance. Our experiment with a jury-rigged Bismarck system like Obamacare, it has not gone well. It's gone okay. It's better than nothing, but it has not gone well. And so I think that Bernie has definitely led on that and is the best candidate on the healthcare issue. So basically I'll agree with you about this.
So one quick question before we pivot away from healthcare. In your discussion with Megan Day, I was just watching that, you know, you sort of floated Medicare X, like which, as I understand it, is some sort of, you know, Medicare for all who want to buy into it scheme.
It's a public option scheme, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's one of – now there are many of those out there.
Right.
Like many people are floating public option. I think public option's fine. I think that it would grow into effectively a national health insurance system. And I think that Yeah, no, I think it's a good plan. My own personal preference would be for a Japan type system, which a lot of people aren't going to like here and probably isn't going to get done here. But my own personal preference would be for extending the Medicare system to actually just cover everybody, whether they want to buy into it or not, and turning that into the universal healthcare system. But like I said, those distinctions I don't think are as important as people think. And people like to fight about public option versus, you know, single payer all day.
We do. I was angling for it, but
maybe that's a good fight, and one's much better. But I'm not confident. I'm not confident to say this is better. No, public option. You can keep your plan. No, I'm not going to say that. We need national health insurance of some sort. We know that that works, sure. And I'm not going to split hairs about what kind it's going to be. So and Bernie has been out in front with proposing a very concrete plan. That would work and would be better than what we currently have. And, you know, I'm not going to yell at Bernie by saying like, oh, I can think of a slightly better thing. You sure. Suck. No, like, yeah. So okay. Bernie's been great on healthcare.
Okay. So how about the higher education issue? Because there, I think you see a little bit of a clearer distinction, So what Bernie has advocated in terms of both eliminating tuition at public universities for people who are students right now and in the future, and also in terms of forgiving student debt for those who are in the past, is a sweeping universal program. And Elizabeth Warren, as I understand it, and this does strike me as a place where she is somewhere in between, right? You know, the two other factions of the Democratic Party, that she has proposed plans that that go a long way towards those same goals, but are much more complicated. And one crucial difference is that they're means tested. So you have so if you're above a certain income threshold, you might have to pay something to go to college, and certainly you have to pay off your student loans. And my instinct is always that's a bad idea for a couple reasons. One of which is that one of which is that it's just not as simple a pitch. It's harder to get people excited about it. The more sort of internal complexity there is, the more you say, okay, we'll give this to people in this income category, this slightly different things to people in this other income category. Another issue is that you're always going to have, anytime something's means tested, you're always going to have a gray area of people who are just above the cutoff. But who could like really benefit from it. And those people are going to resent being taxed to support this thing for people who are below the cutoff. And then my final concern is that when you have universal, as kind of the difference between, Obamacare, which you mentioned, our attempt at the sort of jerry-rigged Bismarck style plans, and a good way to put it, and programs like Canada's Medicare or Britain's NHS, which are different from each other in important ways, but what they have in common is that they're universal. And so, like in Canada, even conservatives have to pretend that they want to support continuing that system. You know, that they have in Britain, even the Tories have to pretend that they want to say
that's how know that that succeeded, because everybody likes it and no one wants to get rid of it.
Exactly. Whereas Obamacare, the Republicans literally spent 2 years symbolically voting to repeal it and still won, elections after that. And so I tend to think that that's linked to the fact that those are universal programs, that like part of the reason that, that there's such an outcry every time somebody talks about, cutting Social Security is that everybody gets Social Security. Everybody pays into it. Everybody benefits from it. And so other than
now, Social Security is means tested.
In what sense?
So Social Security, it's not completely proportional to your income, but there is some proportionality. If you have higher wages and you earn more over the course of your life, Social Security will pay you more when you're old.
Okay, but they,
this is not true of Medicare. This is not true of Medicare, but it's true of Social Security. Social Security was originally, it was a massive compromise by the New Dealers. A lot of people wanted to have just a flat pension, but But instead, they made it roughly proportional to income. Obviously, there's a cap and blah, blah, blah. But Social Security is means tested in that the more you earn, the more you get. And sure. It's not when we say means tested, we usually mean the less you earn, the more you get. Social Security is the more you earn, the more you get. It's actually proportional to your earnings. So being a wealthier person actually makes you get more from Social Security. And it's universal. It kicks in at a certain age. So it's not universal in terms of age, and it's not universal in terms of income. It's I'm not sure I'd call it a universal thing. Everybody gets it to some extent, but some people get a lot more.
Okay. But I would still push the point that the fact that that everybody gets at least something, right, means that it is going to be much harder politically to mess with it than things that like some people like assume rightly or wrongly that they'll never need, right? You know, that they have that like if they that they'll never benefit from, right? You know, that like in other words, right. You know, there are lots of people who assume rightly or wrongly that they'll never need, you know, unemployment assistance or, you know, things like that.
Right. But okay, let's talk about political power and interest group opposition. So sure. If you do, suppose you do a policy that benefits 90% of people on the backs of 10 very rich people,
yes.
10% of very rich people,
sure.
Top 10%. Mm-hmm. There's top 10%. That's not a universal program in the case in that 10% of people are always going to oppose it. But then it's very difficult to get any progressive system if you assume that the 10% of richest people will have veto power over programs. And part of Bernie's whole, you know, sort of movement is about reducing the power of the top richest people so they don't get a veto. So if you say, for example, we're going to make the 10% of richest people actually pay for universities to subsidize education for poor people. Mm-hmm. Through tuition, let's say, instead of the tax system. All right. We can argue about which of those is better, but the dollars are going to get paid and someone's going to pay them and it's going to be rich people. So suppose you pay it through tuition instead of the tax system. You have 10% richest people subsidize the other 90%. If they get a veto.
Interject here that the tuition screwed. Would have to be amazingly high for that to be, you know, for you to get more money from that than you would from taxation. But keep going.
That's fair enough. Okay. Yeah, well, we can talk about like dollar amounts later, but suppose that we have, you know, a few rich people paying for a lot of poor and middle class people. You can only implement that system if rich people don't get a veto, right? And so worrying about any sort of system that's ultimately progressive will be the cost will be paid by the richer people.
Mm-hmm.
And if we say we need programs that are universal in the sense that even rich people will support them, we're not going to be able to get progressive programs because
sure.
They're giving the top rich people a veto.
Sure. I don't think that you're going to get programs that the richest people are going to support for the obvious reason that, for the same reason that I always – that it was always silly when, for example, in the 2016 primary debates, Hillary Clinton – got an applause line by saying that she didn't want to pay for Donald Trump's kids to go to college, which, of course, A, they most likely wouldn't go to public universities, but B, even if they did, so what, right? You know, they have it would clearly be a net loss for the Trump family, right? You know, that they have, like, if you want to extract money from the richest people, it's probably not going to be the most efficient way to do that to charge them, you know, to attend public university.
Just use taxes instead.
Yeah, just use taxes. Exactly.
Yeah, you can use taxes. There's nothing wrong with that.
So.
But will rich people like this system more if they pay through taxes than if they pay through tuition? Look,
and you're absolutely right about this part, right? This is, you know, this is worth being clear on. So of course, the richest people are going to object to any of this stuff because regardless of you're right, any version of this, right, they would be a net negative for them, right? In fact, for the very richest people, probably the more people are covered by it, the more of a net negative it's going to be for them because, you know, you're going to have to tax them even more if
right.
You're going to pay for it by some sort of progressive taxation. So I don't think it's I wouldn't worry about trying to say, oh, I want like a program that even the richest people are going to buy into and support because they benefit from it, because I'm sure it's going to be a net negative. What I would worry a little bit more about is people who, you know, who are, you know, it's the vaguest category in politics, but, you know, middle class, right, you know, who might or who are on the borders of being middle class, who depending, you know, who might not not support something because they thought that they weren't going to benefit from it. Or
wait, even, so what so income rank are we talking? What income level are we talking about here? Like 200K or something? 150K?
So I mean, I think that this is also gets us into the theory of change question, because of course you can look at where the exact numbers are set in a proposal that's laid out, you know, during a campaign, but the detail, you know, but of course those details are going to be politically negotiated in the course, you know, of getting it, you know, of getting it passed. So, and if you have, if what you're starting with is the idea that, well, okay, we're going to provide this benefit for most people in some sort of, you know, in some sort of means tested way, then it's a lot easier to claim it as a victory when you end up at the end of negotiations both saying that, like, you know, we have some much, you know, much much lower threshold for cutting it off, but at least we basically got it, right? And so, whereas I think if you start out by saying, no, what we're really aiming at here is a universal program, then what counts as a win is going to be much clearer there. That there's going to be a lot less room for saying, hey, you know, let's settle for this. This is most of what we wanted.
But I think everyone knows that a program that gets called universal has to be paid for by someone. So the question is, it's really a question of, like, where do you set the cutoff? You know, who pays and who gets paid? So we know that the very rich are going to pay, and we know that the poor are going to not pay. But in between that, as you said, there's a vast group of people that someone's going to call middle class. And the question is, who among those will pay? And the question is, suppose that we say, okay, everybody with families, and we can set it on a sliding scale so there's no, like, hard cutoff that people try to avoid, all that stuff. But suppose that we say that anybody whose family makes under $200,000 a year will not pay a cent of tuition. And I think that's already what Stanford does. It's a, you know, hoity-toity private school, but I think it already sets $200,000 family income as the cutoff. The question is, am I, you know, would I like to make – would I like to make college free even for kids earning – whose families earn $200,000 to $300,000 a year? Yeah, maybe, but I'm not going to necessarily spend political capital and go to bat for those people to get, you know, free stuff. And obviously that's not Trump, right? Trump has fake billions, but, you know, he's got lots of money. And but so that's not paying to send Trump's kids to college, but it is like, you know – a lot of people in, like, upper management or whatever, or like the finance industry or stuff, are out there making $200,000, $300,000 a year, and maybe someone thinks of them as middle class. But the question is, like, are they going to be net payers or net payees in the progressive higher education system? I'm not sure I'm necessarily willing to go to bat for those people.
Yeah, so I guess one distinction that seems to me to be worth making there is that we want to say that there's that it's not just a matter of who pays, and then when we talk about, you know, then we can, like, argue about whether it's better to have them pay through tuition, or in the case of health insurance, maybe through premiums, or whether it's better to have them pay through taxes. There is also a question about, like, just which of those ways of organizing it is going to be better, right? So this is very this is very off brand for me, right? You know, cause I'm supposed to be on the, you know, class war side of this, you know, this discussion, but even if we had, like, a not very progressive tax to pay, for example, for Medicare for All, right? You know, like, even if we had, like, it capped at a certain point, so people weren't actually, you know, paying a higher percentage once they got beyond a certain income threshold, and it, like, most of it fell on ordinary people. It would still plausibly cost most regular income, middle income people less than it would cost to have them be paying private insurance premiums, just because public systems are just much more efficient. None of it's going to profit. You know, you have a much less, you might have much less overhead, you know, et cetera. So it's not purely a question of whether, of like, who's being redistributed to from and who's being redistributed to. That question of whether you're paying at the point of service or you're paying through taxes, you know, might actually still matter for other reasons.
All right. Well, that's another issue that I also wanted to talk about with respect to college.
Yeah.
One reason I'm afraid of completely getting rid of the tuition-based system, and mm-hmm. this fear might be unfounded and I might be just completely full of crap here, but so when you make everything dependent, so in the United States, we're going to make it dependent on state funding, right? Most universities are not national universities, and even though I've called for the establishment of a system of national universities like the Indian one, mm-hmm. I don't see it happening soon, and it takes universities time to build up prestige and blah, blah, blah. So we're going to be stuck with state universities, and state universities state funding for state universities, even if it only funds like 30% of university budgets like now, is really volatile. And you'll get Republican governors, and you'll get people like Scott Walker. Mm-hmm. You'll get Republican legislatures. We can't, you know, expect that we can completely get rid of budget cutters forever. And sure. there's going to be, you know, some sort of political risk there. And you could even see between states a race to the bottom where the states that have high taxes to pay for, you know, universities, you know, people move away from those states. Actually, one thing is that all, and we can talk about that later, but we actually do see a decent number of like rich people moving to low tax states, not out of the country, but we actually do see that. So that's an extreme case. Okay. But I do worry about Scott Walker's getting elected and screwing with university budgets. If you're only 30% dependent on Scott Walker for your budget, maybe you can weather the storm by increasing tuition a bit and by admitting more international students who pay much higher – you charge much higher tuition for, which is essentially an export industry, right? We're exporting education to China and wherever. But then if you rely on it 100% on the good graces of Scott Walker for tuition, the political risk there scares me. And that's the reason it worries me, and I don't know whether that's a valid worry or not.
Yeah, well, so first of all, I do agree that it would be much better if we just federalized the universities, but fair enough, not going to happen, you know, imminently. So I think that there are two interesting issues there. One of which is how is what we're concerned with Scott Walker doing and what the fallout of that is going to be. So in other words, like one thing. That we're not, you know, in terms of the political risks, right? One thing that we rightly don't worry about when it comes to like local budget cuts is that they're going to start if New York City is cutting its municipal budget, it's going to try to make ends meet by charging some sort of fee for service for the police and fire departments. We're not worried that that's going to happen because people are used to having those be free city services, and there would be a huge uproar if there was an attempt to roll that back. And also, of course, in the existing system, you know, one of the reasons it's so bad that, you know, that Scott Walker, you know, cuts Wisconsin's state university budget system is precisely that means that ordinary people are going to have to pay more in tuition to go there. So if combining those points, if people were accustomed to having university tuition be free and there was going to be a huge uproar in any attempt to go back, then I think it's not that there's nothing at stake. It's not that there's nothing to worry about, of course, from the Scott Walkers of the world. But the people that would be threatened by that would be more people like me, right? That I would lose my job,
But you're out there fighting Scott Walker anyway. If he tries to, or whoever the equivalent is in Georgia, I mean, like you'll be out there fighting those people no matter what, even if it's 30% or 100% that the state is paying.
Sure, but I would rather have the biggest danger of that be that I would lose my job than that people there are more people who just can't afford to go because tuition has been increased.
I see.
I don't want to get us too far off track, but you said something interesting a minute ago about the sort of danger of rich people moving from state to state, you know, to avoid, you know, taxation rates. And I think that there's actually something important there, because this is an argument I don't hear very much, but I think there's an important argument there that you could make in favor of when it comes to like a lot of ambitious Sanders-ish proposals on subjects like minimum wage or rent control, for having these be national increases, yeah. Right?
You know, as I said that, I realized that's not actually a threat. So the threat of like rich people moving out is not a threat if you give national matching funds to universities. You don't we don't have to, you know, create federal universities, but we can dispense money to state universities.
Right.
Yeah. So I'm not really worried about that. I do worry about one thing. So but states would still have some budgeting power over universities.
Sure. Yep.
And okay, so there's a couple more things that I worry about. Two more worries.
Sure.
The first worry is that state governments do understand education and the value of education to some degree, because everybody gets an education, and all the people in politics went to college pretty much,
right?
For better or worse, and so we do understand that. However, a lot of what universities do is research, and if you ask why America has quote unquote the best university system in the world, when people say that, they're not even talking about the quality of the education, which almost no one bothers to even measure. They're talking about the quality of the research. The United States got a huge technological boost when we went from the British system, the old British system of essentially, you know, sort of like education as finishing school for the elite, to the German system of education for the elite, cross-subsidizing research. Cross-subsidizing means they pay for one thing and it goes to another. And so research is an incredibly important part of what our universities do, but I'm not sure I trust state politicians or even national politicians as opposed, you know, to understand that. Everyone thinks of universities as schools, as K through 16 or something. And when really research is a huge part of what universities do and not a part of what high schools do. And it's the big difference. And it really, you know, it helps the United States maintain technological supremacy, which allows us to occupy a higher place in international value chains and do blah, blah, blah. I could go on all day. Research is really important. And I'm not sure, that a zero tuition system will be able to completely subsidize research. Obviously, you have the NHS, you have the NIH, you have federal subsidy grants for research, but that typically doesn't pay like professors' salaries or a lot of other university employees' salaries, which are very important for research, and it doesn't construct the facilities. So tuition money goes to pay for a lot of the inputs into the research that makes us like quote unquote the best universities in the world. So I worry about that as a consequence of disestablishing the tuition system.
Mm-hmm.
And I've noted that in fact, that's probably one reason why European universities in Germany and the UK have moved toward charging tuition, so that they can use that money on university research, because they realized they were kind of lapped by the United States, in Germany where the system began.
Yeah. So my understanding, and maybe you have more recent information than I do, is that Germany had moved back to charging tuition, and then that was very unpopular, and then they moved back to the tuition-free system. Is that wrong?
Oh, you know what? Maybe they did. I remember because my friend was a German government researcher who was studying the change when they did tuition a few years ago. But I should look that up. That's interesting. But I think that the rationale for charging tuition was so that they could cross-subsidize research, whether or not that proved to be, you know, politically feasible.
Yeah.
I worry about that.
Well, you know, and I do think that something that, you know, that there's probably an underlying issue there that social democrats and socialists should think more about, that goes towards the university issue, and it also goes to socialized healthcare, that, you know, in like a world where, you know, where in that case, right, if we were trying to imagine a world without big predatory for-profit pharmaceutical companies, you know, medical research, you know, granted a lot of that state subsidized already, et cetera, but I still think that that's an under-conceptualized part of the way that a lot of us, you know, people on, you know, on the left think about how these things, these systems could work in the future.
Right. Now consider, you're in philosophy, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, philosophy research is not scientific research, but one would hope that it benefits the world. I think you'd say sure. that it benefits the world. And economics and social science, sociology and anthropology and humanities yeah. and whatnot, history, all, you know, if you think this benefits the world, almost, very, very little of that is getting funded by the government. That all comes out of university budgets. I'm not so sure that, you know, maybe the John Kasiches of the world and the you know, these governors are willing to spring for education. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they're willing to spring for that kind of research. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, like, I could imagine just like if you think, you know, humanities research budgets are, you know, in trouble now, imagine mm-hmm. if, you know, universities couldn't even sort of get tuition money to fund them. But actually, so I don't want to belabor that point. There's another thing I wanted to mention, which is that there's another way, a third way that universities get money, which has become increasingly important in recent years, which is alumni contributions.
Sure, sure.
Now, alumni contributions, you will probably still be able to get even under a free college system, even mm-hmm. under a system where you ban all tuition, you can still get alumni contributions. Now, you could ban charitable contributions to universities, which is going to starve universities of a lot of money and require big tax increases. Mm-hmm. Maybe you can do that. But if you don't ban charitable giving to universities, then what you get is a system where universities want to fund themselves and the research activities that they do through alum contributions. And if you want alum contributions, what kind of people do you want to let into your university? The kids of the rich. This is a little paradoxical because you wouldn't think that eliminating tuition would make universities more desirous of admitting the children of the rich. But in fact, if you become more percentage-wise, if you become more dependent on alum contributions, or if that becomes the only sort of variable way that a university independently of the state government can just decide on its own to get more money, right? The thing about tuition is university bureaucrats, university administrators can decide, okay, we're going to raise tuition, we're going to charge more tuition to international students, blah, 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 to get more money if we need more money for something we think we need. But under a state finance system, the only way they can do that is by soliciting more alumni contributions. That's the only way the university can independently get money. And so they're going to say, we need alumni contributions. What kind of students are going to get us those? Rich kids. Let's let in a whole bunch of rich kids. I'm not sure that is something I want to encourage.
Yeah. So I would want, you know, like rather than try and do this a priori, I would like to see some, you know, some evidence, because I think we have, you know, like, this is not an entirely untried thing, right? You know, as you mentioned, there are countries in the world that, you know, that already have this, or, you know, or have had it at some point in the past. There are places, you know, there are state university systems in the United States that used to be tuition free, you know, et cetera. So I think right. You know, you can I would like to see some empirical evidence, especially about the claim that, like, if everybody who could get into college anywhere could could do so tuition free, I would be very surprised if this effect that you were talking about was so widespread and so deep that ended up with a larger percentage of children of high income families, going to college than
not going to college, going to the top colleges. Mm-hmm. So it'll, in other words, the quality ranking of colleges. And I'm not sure that research quality is a good proxy for teaching mm-hmm. quality. And I'm not sure if this matters. So it might be that you can get just as good an education going to Cal State as you can going to Berkeley. And that it doesn't really matter how we allocate students between the public universities. They're all going to learn basically the same thing. Maybe that's the case. But if the universities that we consider quote unquote best or top, which certainly will carry some prestige value and sort of value in the labor market, even if their education isn't really better, there'll be some kind of signaling there, I think. But if those prestige universities, if rich kids go there because they need the alumni contributions to support the research activities that keep them at the top of the prestige hierarchy, I almost ran out of breath saying that. If they if they do that, then the Berkeleys and the UCLAs of the world will get all the rich kids, and the rich kids will get the good education and network with each other and blah 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 blah, and get all the, you know, high class diploma for like plum jobs, and then all the poor kids will go to, you know, Cal State Fullerton, and not that there's anything wrong with Cal State Fullerton, but you're going to get this assortative kind of thing. Sure. And maybe that's bad.
Yeah. Well, I guess what I would say about that is, one, I think that if you're concerned about you know, rich kids getting to go to better colleges than poor kids go to, then I think that sort of consideration, you know, if many poor kids can't go to college at all, or think twice about going to college at all, because, you know, because they're going to be saddled with, you know, massive student debt. It's going to pay them decades, you know, to pay off, etc. Then I think that that's, you know, that sort of situation, you know, is likely to have it be more the case that there's a gap between the higher education opportunities for the poor and the higher education opportunities for the rich. And of course, I understand that this is all pitch for, you know, some in-between option where we maybe cover people's tuition up to a certain income threshold. But I would also point out that if the only people who are paying tuition are people who come from families above a certain threshold, then now universities really have an incentive to let in as many of them as at all possible.
I know. Either way, you get an incentive to let in the rich kids.
All right. So
so the question is, how do we change that? Like, right. how do we change that incentive? So I recently wrote an article. I don't know if you read it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, we had a little lag there.
No,
go for
it. I didn't
mean to talk over you. Yeah. So recently I wrote an article saying that, yeah, the tuition stuff and, you know, is interesting. But actually there's some other steps we can do to equalize opportunity that have relatively little to do with the monetary cost. Need-based financial aid means that in-state public four-year tuition for people from the bottom two income brackets is effectively zero already, mm-hmm. or extremely close to zero, or negative actually for the lowest quartile or quintile. And in other words, poor kids aren't paying to go to state schools much already in terms of tuition. What they're paying is room and board, and they're paying the opportunity cost of not being able to work at, you know, McDonald's or whatever to support their, like, you know, ailing mom or something. And that's a huge real cost for them. Room and board is a big cost that's, you know, even Sanders's plan doesn't say free room and board for everybody. It offers grants to help people pay for room and board, but it's not free room and board. If you look at the actual, like, working class and poor people, all of their financial cost is room and board already at public schools in state. And,
I nitpick a little bit, but keep going.
All right. Well, so room and board costs are a big thing, but also there's massive disparities in who goes to college and who finishes college, you know, between poor and rich people. And there's lots of evidence suggesting that the time and the complexity and the cost of actually applying to college and applying for financial aid is a big barrier. So I suggested a system where we have universal college application, where everybody just gets time in school with appropriate help to apply for colleges and financial aid as well. It's all included, just one thing. Everybody does it. All those applications are sent to a central clearinghouse, and people choose which, you know, like 5 schools or 10 schools or something, however many schools, to send that application to for like priority, so every college doesn't have to read every person's application. But then basically a universal application system. And so Cal State already has something like this, a single application. So why not just make that for at least all public schools within each state, if you're going to consider in-state, and maybe you could have alliances of states where you have even bigger networks, where you have single applications between, like, I don't know, Michigan and Ohio, or, I mean, obviously the best would be nationwide, but I don't think we're getting it anytime soon. But so suppose you had these unified application systems where everybody just applies to, like, all state schools with just one application. They all get time and assistance in school, in public school, to do. I think that would be a big help in terms of equalizing opportunity, in addition to, you know, purely financial things.
Yeah, no, sounds good to me. I, you know, Absolutely. So, so the awkward pivot I was going to make is because we were sort of heading, you know, close to, you know, this sort of the amount of time we were talking about doing this for.
Let's go longer. I got time.
Since we have how about this then? I think that, you know, if you say, all right, so no matter how we, you know, we might have a disagreement about which system for financing colleges is most likely to have this problem, but we agree that that you're probably not going to completely eliminate incentives for universities to admit more
rich kids.
To admit more rich kids, you know, than poor middle class ones. We can talk about things that you can do to reduce or try to counteract that. But you know, you're going to get that. Which, of course, is a function of if you have large wealth gaps, then they're going to give people advantages in all sorts of areas of life and kind of.
How do we eliminate the wealth gaps?
Yes,
that's what we're talking about.
Yes.
All right. And the question is, wealth taxes, income taxes, other stuff. What are we going to do?
Yeah,
I think I could go, or you want to go? I'll go. I'll go.
No, you go.
It's an econ kind of thing. The clearest answer to how we're going to do this is all of the above. Taxes, the problem with taxes is people avoid them and are very good at avoiding them. Mm-hmm. The solution is to have different kinds of taxes, which is sort of a defense in depth. You have this layered defense. If your money escapes the income tax, you get hit with the wealth tax.
Right.
And that's the most effective way, I think. And, So wealth taxes are a piece we don't have yet. European mm-hmm. countries tried them, and most European countries ended up getting rid of them because they didn't raise a hell of a lot of revenue compared to what projections were. Only three really kept them. Spain, which has a very, very high top wealth tax of 3.75% that absolutely no one pays because mm-hmm. they just – you know, established residents in a different province of Spain. Switzerland, which has a top wealth tax of 0.94%, which almost nobody ever pays. And Norway, which has a top wealth tax of, I believe, 1.5%, which almost nobody ever pays. However, they do pay a 0.5% wealth tax in a lot of these countries, the countries that kept them. Europe is in a different situation than America because rich people can actually pretty easily move in Europe. So I think Europe is a place where people sort of are worried about the rich people moving phenomenon. United States, you can move to Canada, I guess. If you're really, really stinking rich, you can move to like Singapore, like that Facebook guy. But most people aren't going to move, I think. So wealth taxes, we can actually afford to raise a higher wealth tax here than we can, than they can in Europe. We're advantaged in this way because we're so big. You know, we're big and important and you can't really leave very easily. So the question is, how high can you actually raise the wealth tax, or do you want to raise the wealth tax? Now, if what you really care – I just wrote about this the other day actually. If what you really care about is just reducing the amount – the wealth disparities on paper, those graphs that show like the giant lopsided wealth distribution, mm-hmm. if you just want to smash that, that's not hard. Raise a really high wealth tax in one way or another, you will get rid of it. Mm-hmm. Now, the question is, and so if that's your goal, just boom, you know, you can do it. The question is, and I call that kind of a populist goal, mm-hmm. if that's your target. And that's not necessarily to say that there's anything wrong with it. I know populism has gotten a bad name since Trump. That's right populism. But, you know, left populism is a hallowed tradition in mm-hmm. all societies. So if that's what – I mean, there is some – I think there is value in just purely reducing, you know, paper wealth inequalities. That's not necessarily our only goal. I think that another goal is raising revenue. And the problem with wealth taxes and raising revenue and is not rich people moving, actually. The problem is assets getting written down. So if you raise wealth, the wealth that we record people as having is the current like mark to market price of the things they on paper own, right? So if I have a bunch of stocks, if I have like Apple stock, my wealth is the value of that Apple stock. And that's why all these entrepreneurs look really rich, because people have offered to pay way too much for their companies. And then people offer to pay less for their companies and suddenly they're not in this list anymore. And buy, right? There was this guy who had a Ripple, this cryptocurrency, and it was this massive bubble. And he had like, oh, he has $2 billion. Now he has like $100 million. He's still stinking rich, but he's out of the top list. Anyway, so what happens when you tax wealth is that people are going to be a lot less willing to buy those wealthy things like Apple stock, right? And so the price of that is going to go. Now, can this harm the real economy? Maybe in the short term, it can have like a recession. Because the point is when you have – because those markets are unified, when the price drops for rich people, the price also drops for middle class people. Like the reduction in demand for the asset will drop the price of grandma's pension. So in the short term, if grandma's pension suddenly half her pension goes poof and she's like, oh my god, I've got to stop buying like those little floral scented cakes for my bathrooms or whatever grandma buys, then – consumption goes down and you have a recession. So that's the short-term pain. But eventually we get over recessions. You know, we got over the last one, blah, blah, blah. In the long term, what would be the possible harms of this? Well, it could mess with the corporate system. It could disincentivize investment if you make it really high. I think really the issue is just that it's not necessarily going to raise as much revenue as people expect. And I think that a small wealth tax actually will raise as much revenue as you expect. If you have like a 0.5% or 1% wealth tax, you are going to get quite a lot of revenue. But then the incremental revenue of raising it to like 3% or 4% or whatever is not actually going to get you much more. It might even get you less because asset prices are so volatile. You've heard of the really stupid Laffer curve, right?
Yeah.
Everyone knows the Laffer curve is dumb. The Laffer curve says that if you raise taxes high enough, your revenue actually goes down. And for income taxes, we've calculated the Laffer curve rate is about 85%. If you start taxing more than 85% of income, your revenue actually goes down because people just pay each other under the table. It gets worth it to do that. So, or they just, fuck off or whatever. So the Laffer curve is never a real factor with the kind of taxes that we normally use. Income taxes, sales taxes, all this stuff. But with a wealth tax, because you can have asset prices crash so much, you actually might have to worry about the Laffer curve in terms of revenue.
Yeah. So I do wonder, though. The first thing you said, right, was that that we have two possible goals here, right? One is just increasing economic equality, right. And the other is raising revenue. Those could be in conflict in the same way that they're, if you have if you impose a really high tax on cigarettes for health related reasons, to the extent that you're to raise revenue for it, if
everyone stops smoking and then you at least they're not smoking anymore.
Right, exactly.
Right. And so the question is, I think I care about revenue a lot in this
case. Sure. So fair enough. Let's also think about if you just have fewer people making the most obscenely, great amounts of money, that could have some positive social benefits in and of itself,
right.
that we think certainly in terms of, the outsized, participation you get to have in politics, if you have
no dark overlords or fewer dark overlords.
Yeah, fewer dark overlords of more, more defeatable dark overlords.
To be honest, I don't know how much that'll work if you cut really rich people's wealth in half. Like the amount of money these people spend on politics is actually kind of small relative to their fortunes. And if you take someone with like $1 billion and cut it to $500 million and these people are spending like $50 million on politics, they're going to have less, but they're going to be more pissed off.
So, of course, I think one thing that's always important to emphasize when we talk about this is that actual funding of politicians is only one of many different ways that the 1% makes its will, done politically.
Even like think tanks and, like all that stuff, lobby groups, mm-hmm. that's really important. Right.
Yeah.
And I know a lot about the Koch brothers and their activities.
Sure. Yeah.
They're paradigmatic one.
Yeah. Think tanks, lobbying, Capital Strike, certainly, like the way that Bezos was able to blackmail the city of Seattle. Certainly the way.
Wealth tax won't get rid of that.
It won't, right? But I'm just thinking about like all of the different ways that wealthy people can use their wealth or the things that they buy with their wealth, like companies, to influence politics. But I mean, also
Japan doesn't have a lot of billionaires. In Japan, you still see companies blackmailing the government like that.
Sure. Well, look,
it's just the managers. It's just management doing it. You know.
I mean, look, I think we kind of dove right into the discussion. We kind of skipped intros, but I mean, like, just to be clear about this, right? You know, I have a, I'm a member of the DSA. The outermost limits of my of what I think should be done about economic inequality don't stop with a 8% top wealth tax. We can talk about that, because I mean that is also something that's like underlying the Sanders Warren thing, there's sort of immediate differences in policy proposals, and they have in there even their theories of change as far as enacting reforms. There's also sort of underlying the whole thing, the fact that, you know, I mean, the that that Elizabeth, you know, that part of the underlying divide is that Elizabeth Warren is somebody who, you know, expresses a lot of enthusiasm for capitalism, and Sanders is, you know, she famously said she's, you know, capitalist to her bones, and Sanders is somebody who, regardless of where the limits of the horizons that he might have politically are, is certainly supported by lots of people who have horizons that go beyond that, right? So we can talk about all of that. But one quick point I did just want to make about the wealth taxes was that that just reducing raw inequality through reducing the amount of wealth being hoarded at the top is one benefit. But that and raising revenue through taxation aren't necessarily the only possible benefits, right? I feel a little funny about this because I hate doing a priori, you know, economics, but I mean, one thing that you could certainly hope for, is if you can, you know, if you can keep less of, you know, of the money that you're making as personal wealth, then, you know, then that gives you more of an incentive to put more of it back into investment, you know, less of a disincentive, possibly, you know, to put, like, if you have, you know, if you own a huge company and, you know, and anything that you actually keep in profits is going to be subject to this wealth tax, then that could create an incentive, as I'd understand it, to put more of it in other places that we might hope that you'd put more of it. So
just to interrupt briefly, I think that that actually works much better for a personal income tax than a wealth tax. So with a wealth tax, you're going to end up paying the same amount whether you reinvest or consume. But with a – well, actually, you'll get there's probably more of an impulse to consume, because if I have $100 million, mm-hmm. right, and I have to pay wealth only on stocks and bonds and stuff that I own, but I don't have to pay for a really nice garden because mm-hmm. it's too hard to have an appraiser come out and appraise the value of my garden and tax me on mm-hmm. my garden, then I'm going to buy a garden.
Mm-hmm.
Or something, you'll have people buying physical stuff that doesn't get taxed, but at best it's probably a wash with wealth tax. With income tax, there actually is that. And I think there's a strong argument to be made that the reduction of top income taxes that we saw with Reagan is one reason why our country has been investing less corporations have been investing less, because people have now an incentive to take their money out of corporations as income instead of keeping it in corporations. But the thing is, if you have a wealth tax, even if you keep it in the corporation, you get taxed on it. Does that make sense?
Right.
Investment is a tax shelter from an income tax, but not from a wealth tax.
Gotcha. Okay. So no, that's good to know. Fair enough. So how about the, I don't know how game you are for this, but since, like I said, I think in a way it is sort of underlying a lot of these other disagreements, and of course we could easily spend the amount of time we've spent so far just talking about this, but there is a way to link that sort of difference about long-term horizons to this discussion that we're having right now, right? So here's an easy way, and one that I hope doesn't sound too airily utopian, that if you have So if you think that there's something wrong, not just with insufficiently well-regulated capitalism or with like the wrong industry, you know, like everybody agrees some things should be public services, but we might disagree about which things those should be. But if you think that there's this sort of something wrong with the incentives that are built into the structure of the system itself, then, you know, typically, you know, democratic socialists in this sort of more radical sense of that phrase have advocated, you know, certainly over the last several decades, two kinds of things to address that, right, to change those ownership structures, right? One is expanding the size of the public sector, of course, you know, to be, you know, providing more things as completely decommodify public services. But the other is finding ways, and we could talk about what some of those ways might be, to expand the portion of the private enterprise that's taken up by worker-owned cooperatives. And so there's a way, you know, because if you kind of talk about like, I mean, I realize one of the sort of things when you start talking about, hey, I'm a socialist, not just in that, like, I think that America should be more, you know, like Norway or whatever, right? But I'm a socialist in that I think there's something really wrong with capitalism. Then I think there's a sort of natural impulse to sort of say, okay, well, so, like, are you advocating what existed in the Soviet Union? That didn't work out very well. And if you say no, say, okay, well, you know, are you, you know, that makes it sound even more like a wild leap into the unknown. And people have rational reasons for, you know, being skeptical about wild leaps into the unknown. But I think you can take sort of individual components that maybe have been beta tested under the current system. Like, all right, could, you know, get democratic governments directly administer more things than they do now? Clearly, yes, right? We have examples of that from other Western democracies. Mm-hmm. And then, all right, if you don't want a separation between labor and ownership, could we try to, on the other end, if we want to squeeze out external private ownership of the economy as much as at all possible, could we do that by, while on the one hand expanding the public sector, also expanding the currently very tiny worker cooperative sector? And one reason to do that is the ideological reason that I've been laying out, to sort of achieve these larger socialist goals. But there are also – but we could also tie it into any number of the subjects we've been talking about. So, for example, if you think economic inequality is bad and it's better to – you know, it's good to reduce it, then if you look at, for example, the world's most successful long-running federation of workers cooperatives, the Mondragon Corporation in Spain, even under intense competitive pressure from traditional companies, the highest they've raised the allowable gap between ordinary workers and, you know, ultimately democratically accountable executives to is 9-1. And a lot of the co-ops within it don't even do that, right? They set their own internal rates lower than that. But even when we are talking about 9-1, there are, you know, that's like a galaxy of difference between the sort of pay differentials that we get within like the regular public sector, you know, certainly in the United States, right? Where, you know, I don't know what the most recent figure is. Certainly a couple of years ago, you know, the average CEO to worker pay gap in, you know, in the United States was 287-1. And so there seems to be some empirical evidence that if whether directly.
It's not too bad in Germany, you know.
What is it in Germany?
I don't remember, actually. It's a lot lower. Hold on. I'm gonna look that up while we talk because I have a cell phone.
Good.
Anyway, so
do you think that the in Germany that I mean, obviously this is speculative, but do you think that that might have anything to do with like co-determination schemes? So like, you know, there are workers' representatives sitting on boards of directors and, you know, helping to decide the pay policies.
Well, so I did think that, and I thought that that would actually be an effective way of doing that. Mm-hmm. However, then some research came out showing that some companies were exempted from co-determination, and actually they didn't see any like divergence.
Okay.
So there have been some reforms so that some mm-hmm. companies that were like just on the threshold versus just past the threshold didn't see divergence after that, but it might have. had a broader, longer-term effect on norms of just having workers in the boardroom and recognizing the values of the workers. However, I see now that it's – no, German CEOs actually make something like 90 times the average employee. So, there's a huge gap. It's not like Mondragon.
Yeah, yeah. No. Less than the United States, but in the same universe as the United States.
Oh, no, hold on a sec. This one says it's 12?
Oh, that's interesting.
Okay, what? Okay, I'm it's not. This says for CEOs in the UK, the ratio is 22. In France, it's 15. In Germany, it's 12. Those are the numbers I'd seen before. This other source, UK chief executives. I don't understand this. Okay, so the answer is don't do research on your phone while you're having a debate.
Okay,
so
fair enough.
But I had seen those very low numbers.
And anybody who's watching this is encouraged to look it up themselves at their leisure later.
Yes, I'm going to figure it out afterwards. But okay, so I don't know much about worker cooperatives, and I don't have a heck of a lot useful to say about that. It's an interesting model.
Okay, so just thought, you know, I just thought I'd throw that out there because it's you know, because if you because I think that if you're like if you think that there's something more there's something fundamentally wrong with the status quo, not just wrong in a way that we have to, like, you know, patch it up around the edges, but like wrong in a way that you want to make a deeper change. I think there are two dangers there. One is that you is that you're sort of insanely specific in a way that, like, is probably going to melt away at any contact with reality, you know, because, like, if you're just kind of trying to, you know, to think through in the abstract before trying to implement everything how super dramatic changes could occur, then, you know, then it's that it's easy to just kind of produce something that's silly because there are a lot of things that you don't know how they play out until you tried them, right? That's one danger. But then the other danger, certainly politically, is the more you err on the side of, you know, like that Karl Marx quote about not like sitting around inventing recipes for the cookshops of the future, then the more I think reasonable people are going to say, hey, I'm not going to go along with this until you tell me a lot more than you're telling me, right? You know, I don't want to just make a wild leap into the unknown because, you know, as bad as things are in certain respects under the current system, they could always get worse. And, you know, and what's the – and so there's a so I think that there's an in-between where you can kind of talk about broad organizing principles and try to look at what seems to have worked already. And, you know, and look at, you know, existing worker co-ops, look at existing, you know, cases where more things are nationalized than we're currently used to in the United States. And I think you can build a reasonable case like that. I wonder, though, if since you said that's not an area you know a lot about, maybe.
Well, worker co-ops aren't, but I have some thoughts on socialism as an overall thing.
Sure.
If you want to hear that.
Yeah. Be my guest.
So I think the when socialism first came out, nobody knew what it meant, and they argued about it all day. Mm-hmm. Now people are more likely to spend their day arguing about what neoliberalism means. But anyway, socialism came out, and people didn't know what it meant, and they argued. And this guy named Edward Blum came along and was really he was like, oh, we need to just, you know, evolve things through the democratic process and experiment with things and move in the direction of socialism. People are like, no, you're betraying the revolution. No, you suck.
Are you talking about Bernstein?
I'm sorry, Edward Bernstein. Yes. Yeah. Ah, yeah. Forgot.
Sorry.
I'm stupid. Okay, thank you.
Sorry, keep going.
Okay. Edward Bernstein came out, and the German guy. Yeah. And evolutionary socialism. And so, anyway, he got where did I get – anyway, sorry. Yeah, so he was ultimately that vision prevailed because the countries, you know, when anyone asks, you know, on some shit posting online debate, when you ask a Rose Twitter person, like, where has socialism ever worked? Ask like the grumpy Generation Xer, and the socialist will say Norway, Denmark, yeah, and then that was exactly the vision of the evolutionary socialists. And when you see all the like horrible examples of where it didn't work, it was all the countries that had some sort of revolution, either in, you know, I could name all the countries, obviously. Cuba is probably the least faily country that had a revolution. Cuba has done better than any other revolutionary country, and it's not great. It's not great. It's not terrible, but it's the best. And now we're seeing again Venezuela. I don't know. People don't call it like communist because apparently communist meant like allied with the Soviet Union, which is gone. But now it's, you know, Bolivarian socialism, whatever. It did really badly. And if you look at the reasons why Venezuela did badly, it's not, I mean, it's not just like, oh, they nationalized too much stuff. But you can see some very concrete mistakes that they made that are all related to how they did it politically, I think. So when you look at Venezuela, which is the most recent example of like a big quote unquote socialist failure, you see, what did they do? They raided the state oil company for political purposes. PDVSA was actually really well run, and it was a nationalized company, public company. They raided it for political purposes. It couldn't invest. So oil investment collapsed and your oil revenue went away. They randomly nationalized things owned by political enemies of the regime. Like and this happened under Chavez too, but it picked up under Maduro. They really just, they were like, oh, we don't like you. You said something bad about us. We're going to nationalize you. And so there was massive uncertainty. And then they did some macroeconomic stuff that caused like hyperinflation and all this stupid stuff and price controls and just some really ad hoc crap. But I think that all of these are traceable to politics. All of these are traceable to the need to sustain the image of having this revolution, the need to aggressively smash current institutions and build new things in their place, which were never built, and which is in practice an incredibly hard thing to do. It's like what we tried to do in Iraq when we overthrew Saddam Hussein's guys, and we're like, de-bathification, bye, everyone with experience running this country, you're out, and we're going to bring in random guys to do this, and it was terrible. And so you had the act of revolution itself, I think, often produces this like deeply imaged focused policies that are not very practical, and sort of revenge aggression focused policies that don't really help anybody.
So I think that Venezuela is probably a singularly bad case of socialist failure for a really simple reason that I think is kind of hinted at by what you already said, which is that they, by no matter how you define the word socialism, right? You know, whether you take crazy radical person like me who would emphasize workers' control on the shop floor, or whether you just sort of say like nationalization equals socialism, on any definition, it's very hard to say, to sort of tell this story about how Norway is like, you know, this sort of is like sensible, you know, so like moderate social democracy, whereas Venezuela is a cautionary example about more radical socialism, for the simple reason that that the public sector not only is larger in Norway than it is in Venezuela, which is actually a pretty good one-to-one comparison, because in both cases, the single biggest thing inflating the size of the public sector is the, in one form or another, publicly owned state oil company. But it's actually the public sector in Venezuela is actually, even at the height of the Chavez welfare state, the public sector in Venezuela was smaller than the public sector in France. You know, if you look at the percentage of the population that was working for it. So it seems to me that like whatever you make of Venezuela, and during the first 10 years of Chavez, there were actually some fairly remarkable accomplishments in terms of poverty reduction, healthcare, and other things. Then there was a meltdown, and you know, you could have different theories of the sort of main cause of the meltdown, whether that was because of bad currency management or other things. But one thing that seems like it's not really an available explanation is that like they were trying too hard to smash capitalism and introduce total socialism, given that the main thing that was nationalized in Venezuela was the oil industry, which was actually nationalized before Chavez came to power. He did assert more direct state control over it,
That was already national. Yeah. No. So the Chavez nationalizations were basically, there was a quite a bit of nationalization, but it was done in a haphazard way. And the nationalization probably spurred capital flight and other sort of bad stuff that contributed to the macroeconomic crisis. So basically, a bunch of private business people, you started out with a bunch of private business, and instead of sort of building up state businesses from the ground level, which is how, I mean, that's really how you got PDVSA, right? And that's how you got a lot of the you know, Norwegian oil industry or whatever. That's why Norway owns, the government owns so much stuff, by the way, is because oil industry is a really good candidate for like government ownership. We're weird in that we have these private oil companies, but that's not typical. Most oil companies are government. And instead of sort of building up industry, you know, sort of nationalized industries from the ground level are trying to do that, instead they're just like, we're taking your thing and we're taking your thing, which is not anything Norway ever did. And so, yes, they had less state ownership, but the threat of state ownership caused people to be like, oh my God, hide the money under the mattress, which causes a macroeconomic crisis.
Yeah, I mean,
my argument is not like, oh, nationalized industry never works. Obviously, some things really work. Like, we have a public school system that's nationalized that works much, much better than private school systems ever work. So obviously, sometimes full nationalization of industry absolutely works. And the question is, how do you go about getting from here to there? I think that process is really important. And when I talk about evolution versus revolution, it's not as much what you do, but how you get there.
All right.
And by the way, and I figured out where Blum came from. He was a socialist prime minister of France. I was confusing him with France.
Yes.
Yeah. Sorry.
No problem. So yeah, I think that there are certainly some, you know, examples of Western European democracies that have nationalized industries that came from expropriation of previously private holdings, and that have been, you know, very, very successful. I think the NHS in Britain is a great example. You know, they have like a 45, you know, Clement Attlee, you know, they nationalized, you know, existing hospitals left and right, you know, incorporate them into the NHS. And even after it's been, you know, it's been undermined in various ways in recent decades, you know, it's still certainly producing better results in terms of life expectancy and infant mortality and mortality amenable to healthcare. Certainly than the U.S. system, and, you know, about as well, depending on which numbers you're looking at, as the Canadian system. And similarly, the coal mines there, you know, so there are, I think, examples of successful, expropriations, but I do take part of your point. I think that it's not wrong that, you know, that in, the political environment of Venezuela, that there's a tendency to do a lot of things that you could broadly characterize as, you know, playing hardball politically, ranging from selective expropriations of political opponents, to just sort of, you know, police authoritarianism, you know, certainly contributed to the instability. And, you know, and you can look at that and say, well, that's bad. They shouldn't have done that. This is cautionary tale.
And raiding the oil company, the public oil company.
And I don't think that that's entirely wrong. I certainly think that there are lots of legitimate criticisms to make of, well, even Chavez, who I think is more of a mixed bag and has more defensible characteristics, but especially Maduro, I think that there are legitimate criticisms to make there. But I also think that you have to look at the larger context. You say, okay, is the difference between Venezuela and Norway just a matter of ruling politicians having different instincts about how to go about things? Even, you know, or is something else going on there? And even to the extent that it is about politicians and left parties having different instincts to go about things, why are those instincts so different? And I think that the answer to both questions is that one, you know, is that, look, early, you know, 3 years into the Chavez presidency, when relatively little of this stuff had happened yet. You know, you certainly weren't getting, you know, some of these selective expropriations you're talking about yet. There was a military coup openly backed by the United States. You know, they have and there was an attempt at the, you know, it fizzled, right? You know, but at the same thing, you know, this year, they kind of let Juan Guaido go around to military bases saying, I'm the president, follow me, for a few months, and then arrested him. Whereas, you know, Norway doesn't really have to worry about that. In fact, it's, and you know, because the sort of role of American hegemony in Latin America makes it so difficult to have any kind of left-wing experiment, to have any kind of breathing room there at all, you know, which I think goes across the board. Some of the examples you've already mentioned, Cuba, you know, if you have, again, this is not exculpatory. This doesn't mean that these things shouldn't be criticized. But if you look at why, Fidel Castro and Che Guevara made a lot of the decisions they made in 1959. To put that in context, I think you have to look at what happened in Guatemala in 1954 and the bloodbath, you know, of leftists, you know, following the CIA coup there. Or even like, even again, this is not ancient Cold War history, you know, Aristide, you know, ran for president on a platform of, this is literally a quote, raising the Haitian people from misery to poverty, and ended up being removed by U.S. Marines. In Brazil, where you have somebody who you'd think has like impeccably Norwegian political instincts, Lula da Silva, who had, you know, he didn't, you know, who's willing to moderate a lot of his more radical socialist impulses, you know, make IMF payments, you know, maintain friendly relations, you know, with the region, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And he ended up, his success it all happened within the legal system, more or less, but his successor was impeached on hilariously dubious grounds. Lula himself was by all indications going to win, you know, the next election, since he was eligible to run for another term.
Lula was a pretty effective guy.
Yeah, he was a pretty effective guy, and look what that got them, right? That they have,
you know, who was also very effective is Evo Morales.
Mm-hmm.
In Bolivia. Bolivia has reduced inequality by more than any other Latin American country at a time when inequality is actually falling throughout that region, in almost every country there. Bolivia has led them all and has decreased inequality more. You know, Morales is he calls himself a socialist, and in practice, his program has been basically to do a lot more redistribution in public services. Mm-hmm. He is... lots more programs for the poor, the social services, but not, you know, in excess of what they can pay for. He hasn't starved the you know, national like resource extraction companies or whatever out of money like they did in Venezuela to do that. And it's been quite successful. So in terms of nationalization of industry, there has been a little bit. So mostly extractive industries, which again are, you know, we think are pretty good candidates for nationalization. And so I think he calls himself a socialist, but I think that his approach is very different than the Venezuelan approach, even though they both call themselves Bolivarian socialists, right? There's a huge, even now, the argument over what socialism means is going on at the level of policy. And I think that there are things that work and things that don't work. How, you know, a lot of people, you know, kind of want to refight the Cold War by talking about, you know, how the massive failures of like Mao or Stalin or something were due to like fear of America. I think that's kind of BS, but I also think it's not necessarily worth refighting that.
But I guess the point I would emphasize here, and look, sure, people can be much too reductive about that. I think that if you can't recognize that, you know, like something like the Great Leap Forward was an indictment of internal features of this system, right? The CIA didn't make them do that. You know, you've definitely lost the plot. At the same time, I think especially when we're talking about Latin America, I think you really can't underestimate the role of American interference in creating much right. more, you know, in making Latin American politics much more of a street fight,
right.
In which you people are more likely to yes. do things like that, because this isn't just history from the Cold War, right? They have the you know, the coup, the success, well, the briefly successful coup in Venezuela was 2002. Haiti, Aristide was removed by Marines in 2004. Honduras was 2009. The second attempt in Venezuela was this year. You know, Lula, you know, the the basically lawfare coup in Brazil happened in 2018, and certainly with, you know, and you can talk about the role of the United States in enabling these things or supporting these things is different in different cases. You can't – every case is different. But I think that it's not something that's like a matter of like, okay, you know, back in the 50s these things happened, but like now this is just history and, you know,
right,
and it's not really that's not really part of it. I mean, this is a big ongoing problem. And actually this is also something that might lead into one thing that strikes me. I know we've gone longer than we planned to, but one thing that strikes me as a big difference between Sanders and Warren that we haven't talked about at all, which is foreign policy.
That, all right, we can talk about foreign policy. What I was going to – I was going to pivot to a Sanders-Warren thing based on what I was saying earlier,
which one?
I've always felt – now Bernie Sanders, the man, and the Sanders movement – Sanders slash DSA slash New Socialist movement are different things.
Sure.
Bernie's, you know, he's an old guy. He's not necessarily completely in step even with his own movement. Usually, I think often stuff that his movement wants trickles up to him. But anyway, regardless, from the Bernie movement, there's much more – it feels much more political. It feels much more like a gang. Whereas the Warren movement feels much more ideological. It feels more like a set of ideas. And if Warren suddenly started saying different ideas, or if – then I think that people would go like, okay, no, bye, Warren. And I would. And, you know, it's a conditional support. It's more of a support for ideas and Warren, and also admiration for Warren as a person and the idea that she's a competent, effective executor of these ideas. With Bernie, I feel more like there's, you know, our enemies versus our friends, more gangism. And I don't know a word for that. I don't want to call it tribalism because people have been using that to mean other things. Politics is really the word. It's a political. It feels more like a political movement than an ideological movement to me.
And
that worries me.
That's interesting because I would say I think almost the opposite, because if you look at the way that you know, Now, granted, look, this will be true to some extent of any candidate, but I think that more than usual, I think with Warren, I think there are more cleanly divided different kinds of Warren supporters I'm sure that there are, you know, plenty of people, you know, for whom the policy set is something they care about deeply, and if they have And okay, sure. I don't doubt it, right? You know, but you know, and there are degrees here, right? Because there are lots of people who say a very common thing I hear from Warren supporters, not from you, but from lots of Warren supporters, is, hey, there's no policy difference between Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren worth getting excited about. They're basically the same politically. It's just that like Warren has more detailed plans, or, you know, she'd be more effective at doing things for this reason or that reason, right? That's one very common view.
It's not true. It's false. It's a false view.
I emphatically agree that it's a false view. In fact, I think both halves of it are false, but I have in any case.
Yes. Okay, but I want to ask you a question. All right.
But just really quickly. Sorry. It also seems to me that there are a lot of people who support Warren who like supported Hillary Clinton over Bernie Sanders in 2016, which is a tough fit for me with saying that, like, you know, because you're with saying that, like, you know, it's about the ideas above all else, because if you certainly ask which one of those people in 2016 was closer to the Warren policy set, it would clearly be Sanders. So I do see a lot more about the person there, just as I thought that, like, you know, which – whereas I think that with Sanders, who's an individual, you know, I say this with great love, who's totally lacking in any kind of personal charisma or appeal of any kind, really, you know, that they have there's a sort of strange kind of anti-charismatic charm there, you know, but they have
ranting Jewish grandpa. He's like, corporations.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's charismatic. Yeah, the bird landed on his podium.
I guess. I mean, like, they have like he, if there was ever anybody who just seemed like a shouty vessel for policy proposals, it would be it would be Bernie Sanders. You know, like if you have a, you know, it's not. I mean, look, I think my fondness for loud Jewish grandfathers is probably greater than the national average, you know. But I have a I don't know that out of all the candidates, you know, if I were just, you know, if I just wanted to have one of them, like, you know, be part of my life or even be part of like Thanksgiving dinners, you know, I don't know that Bernie Sanders is the one I would choose, you know. Oh,
Marianne Williamson all the way. Anyway.
Yeah, might be more entertaining.
Crazy, but, crazy new age aunt. All right. Yeah, anyway. But here's my question to you. Here's my question that gets at what I want to say here.
Sure.
Which is, if Warren came out with a wealth tax proposal, right? Yeah. Before that, wealth taxes weren't a commonly talked about thing.
Uh-huh.
I mean, people talked about estate taxes. Bernie had talked about a thing that was sort of like a wealth tax, but was really an expanded estate tax, which I liked, by the way, years before. But then in terms of just like a Europe-style wealth tax, just like shave a percent off your wealth every year, Warren mainstreamed that, really. Now, I mean, and she came out with this big proposal. Everyone was talking about it. Then okay, Bernie
Sanders did propose something called a wealth tax in 2014, but keep going.
Yeah, no, I know. But it wasn't quite the same. But anyway, the point is that nobody really talked about it, and Warren was the first to make this a pillar of the campaign. Here's the question. If Warren's proposal for the wealth tax had been exactly the same numbers that Bernie's are now, you know, starting out at 3% and going up to 8%, whatever, for exactly the same brackets. If that had been Warren's proposal to start out with, what would Bernie's proposal be now? Would it be the same, or would it be double what he proposed? And I mean, it's a rhetorical question. We can't know. My guess is that it would be double or substantially higher, because the goal was to create policy daylight. Now, that doesn't mean he wouldn't really want those numbers. Maybe he'd want any number of wealth tax would be fine with him. But my guess is that those numbers were set. It feels very, you know, 7-minute abs. Do you know that reference?
Mm-hmm.
Like there was 8-minute abs, and then there was the ranty guy in the back of the car saying, 7-minute abs. It feels very 7-minute abs. And that's not necessarily wrong. Like maybe a higher rate is better. Why not do 7-minute abs if you can get abs in 7 minutes? But my feeling is that if there had been policy similarity between the two, Bernie would, you know, increase and just amp up whatever proposals. Like on Saturday Night Live, he's like, I'm going to turn it up to a 10. I feel like that's actually what he's doing. And because it's political, because he's outflanking Warren or trying to, with, you know, taking similar proposals and just amping up the numbers. Warren said, you're going to forgive most student debt. I'm going to forgive all student debt, you know, like, whereas Warren, Bernie was first on healthcare, right? Bernie was first on healthcare. Warren didn't bother trying to outflank Bernie on healthcare. She just said, you know what? I'll do that.
So, well, okay. First of all, I think that we need to know a lot more about what Warren has in mind on healthcare before we can do a comparison of them. But okay, secondly, sure. I think that when it comes to something like the wealth tax, sure, I don't really know what, you know, what Bernie's, you know, like what sort of, you know, when he issued the proposal, he certainly hinted that he thinks that like something even higher than this, you know, would be reasonable, right? You know, but they have I don't know where, you know, if he had a magical wand to just like not worry about getting it through Congress or whatever, and like he could just like have whatever wealth tax institute he wanted to, I don't know where that would be set. But I think that when it comes to student debt, I think that's much less susceptible to the 7-minute abs interpretation, because what he's proposing is student debt is so obviously consistent, and I don't, you know, I mean, like, even it could be that Warren proposed her first. That's not my memory of the order, but whatever. That's beside the point, right? I think that they have regardless of which order they're proposed in, I think that Sanders' proposal is exactly what you would expect Sanders to propose if you were going to say something about student debt, because it's exactly consistent with his general political instincts and his worldview that, you know, that you have – that Sanders is somebody who tends to go for completely universal programs, you know, that's consistent with what he's proposed in any number of other areas, you know, whereas – Warren is about what you'd expect Warren to propose, right? You know, that they have a – so whether the dynamic was Warren started out proposing something more moderate and then that Sanders proposed a more sweeping one, or the way I remember it, which might be inaccurate, which was that Sanders proposed the sweeping elimination of student debt, where then Warren proposed the more complicated, nuanced one.
Which was the opposite. She did first.
Okay. Like I said, that wasn't my memory, but you could be right about that.
Okay. Well, yeah. Okay.
So, but whichever one of those happened, like, look, if Elizabeth, if you said in 2016, right, if we were just talking, like, we didn't know that Elizabeth Warren was going to run in 2020, right, which we wouldn't have, right, you know, down in 2016, you could be fairly sure that unless he had a major health setback, Bernie Sanders was going to run in 2020 because he kind of never stopped. But they have a – but really? In if we're having this conversation in 2016 and I said, hey, if you thought – if Bernie Sanders was going to run again, and when he ran again, instead of just talking about free tuition, he was also going to propose doing something about student debt – given everything you know about Bernie Sanders, what would you expect him to say about student debt? I'm sure you'd say, yeah, I'd expect him to just say it shouldn't exist, so we're just going to eliminate all of it.
Yeah, sure. And, you know, but I would note that Bernie's proposals in this election are far to the left of his proposals in the last election. And his rhetoric in this election is far to the left of his rhetoric in the last election. And there's several reasons why that could be. One reason is because he succeeded in moving the electorate to the left, and the Overton window has been moved by him, by AOC, and by other politicians, and simply what's possible now was not possible then. An absolutely valid possibility. Another possibility is he's got to run to the left of Warren to put daylight between them. And that's not saying – that's not a bad thing. I'm not saying you suck. You should just do exactly everything that Warren does. But I am saying that it seems – a lot of the differences that have emerged, the substantive differences between the two, have been, I think, prompted by Bernie, not Warren moving to the right of Bernie, but Warren establishing a position and then Bernie moving to the left of that. And so that to me feels political more than it feels ideological. And maybe I'm being uncharitable. Maybe it's just that, you know, too many Rose Twitter people have sent me stupid GIFs on Twitter and I just got pissed. Not really. I don't really care. But maybe, like, people do think that way. But I think that, like, it really felt to me like Warren was something new in the campaign and was not simply a watered-down Bernie or a I felt that she was different, that she was proposing things. There's a number of things she's proposed that Bernie hasn't actually even, you know, addressed at all, and that I don't expect him to or care if he does. I'm just saying that that he hasn't. So Warren felt different. She was suddenly talking about, like, co-determination, export promotion. Nobody was talking about those things. That wasn't in 2016. She didn't feel like she was on the same linear spectrum of left to right. She felt like she was a new and different thing to me. And that's what drew me to her. Bernie... but some of her things were just absolutely progressive things, wealth tax, student debt forgiveness, et cetera, and garnered a lot of attention. And then I felt like Bernie exceeded those in order to differentiate himself. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing to do. You got to win elections. I definitely feel this, like, you know, this guardianship that there's, like, the gatekeeping on the left. Did you see, you know, so Megan Day, I had the earlier blogging head tweet. Mm-hmm. Did you see her tweet yesterday? She was like, everyone knew Bernie was going to run. Warren, you know, is bad because Warren chose to enter the race that was essentially Bernie's.
So my understanding of the point that she was making with that tweet, because I saw your response to it, and I think I read it a little bit differently, right, is not that, like, you know, it's is not that Elizabeth Warren, you know, is bad because she also decided to run, but that if you think that the fact that instead of there being, like, sort of one unified progressive block, right, you know, that there's, like, animosity between Warren and Sanders camps, you know, you have to say that the origin point of that is Warren's decision to do what she knew, you know, even if she actually declared, you know, slightly earlier or whatever, you know, I don't think I mean, like I said earlier, I think that, like, in December 2016, I think you could have confidently said that unless he has some major health setback, of course Bernie Sanders is going to run. I mean, he was essentially, even when he was campaigning for Clinton, he was essentially going around the country giving Bernie Sanders campaign speeches when peppering in the phrase, you know, Hillary Clinton understands that. Right. So I think that it was always clear that Bernie Sanders was going to run. And so for better or for worse, when Warren decided to run, she knew that she was running against Bernie. And that doesn't mean that she couldn't have had legitimate reasons for doing that, or that, like, that's not a, you know, that's or that that's like an intrusive.
I don't know, man. I mean, the idea is that, like, why should Bernie, even before he declares that he's going to run, why should he just be considered to, like, you know, be like candidate in perpetuity, to own the left in absentia, to be like king of the left in absentia, you know, like,
I mean, I just,
why?
I just think that realistically, I think it's very rare to not know whether somebody's running until they actually hold the press conference.
I admit that I was fooled. A lot of people said maybe Bernie won't run, or I don't think Bernie will run. And so I actually thought there was a substantial chance that Bernie would not run. But that just, maybe that just means I'm stupid and everyone else knew what was obvious and I just didn't get it.
Or it could just be that we, you know, I mean, look, I wouldn't want to get too hung up on this, because I think that, like, it could be that, you know, it could be that we just had different
expectations.
Yeah, different expectations based on different reads of his behavior. But I do want to go back to the point that you're raising about the dynamic between Warren and Sanders in terms of why each of them is proposing the things that they're proposing. Because I hear what you're saying, but I do think that, look, if your concern is that there might be a gap between what a given candidate is proposing, you know, for the sake of, like, staking out a certain position in the primary, and, like, what they're really committed to in some deeper, you know, deeper sense, you know, what they're saying because the dynamics of the primary are causing them to say it, and what they're saying it because they would say it anyway, then I think that you've got to, I don't see how that concern could not be much greater about Warren than about Sanders, considering that there's a lot of stuff that Warren is talking about, you know, about now, like even just, you know, even just Medicare for all, you know, that's not something that, you know, I mean, she co-signed, you know, as she went out on record as a co-sponsor about the same time, you know, that people like Kamala Harris did, you know, because,
right.
You know,
she, like, obviously, like, she was a follower on healthcare. Absolutely.
So
like, she was not the leader on that, but a lot of things she was.
Sure. But I just think that, like, I think that if you, this goes back to, well, goes back to one of the first things I said at the beginning of the conversation, which is that, look, I think there are some people, you know, not all rose emoji Twitter users are created equal. There are some people who have completely lost the plot on this, who think that, like, Elizabeth Warren, like, is secretly Hillary Clinton or something, right? That's ridiculous. They have a, you know, I mean, clearly she is. I've been as critical of Warren as anybody, but, like, if Bernie Sanders had a heart attack tomorrow, I wouldn't think twice about who I was going to vote for in the primary. Of course it would be Elizabeth Warren, right? You know, they have a, right. You know, there's obviously
some people are getting so into the animosity that they might not.
Sure. And that's counterproductive. You know, they have
a, and on the Warren side too.
So clearly
there's people doing that,
but clearly there are. So I think that clearly Elizabeth Warren's natural political instincts are well to the left of sort of centrist establishment Democrats like Clinton or Obama. But I also said that I don't think that they're probably anywhere like as far as to the left as she's had to be dragged by the dynamics of a competitive primary against Bernie Sanders. You know, even when she's got into something first, right, you know, there's that same dynamic there, that they have a, that, like, one part of the set of motivations, we can argue about how big a part of it it is, but part of the set of motivations is going to be, hey, what's a big, bold thing I can propose that this other guy hasn't proposed yet, right, you know, to distinguish us. And I think that if you want to say, yeah, sure, I am sure that Bernie Sanders in many ways is being bolder politically now than he was in 2016 in many different areas. Because in 2016, I think that he's, you know, in 2016, he thought he was going to be running a protest candidacy, right? That they have, he wanted, in fact, in 2016, he wanted Elizabeth Warren to do it instead, because he probably made the calculation that she would be at least a more successful protest candidate against Clinton. You know, he might have worried that he was too far to the left. And I'm sure he wasn't expecting to win 22 states in that race. But because he did, and because now there, you know, we have, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Rashida Tlaib in Congress and, you know, et cetera, everything that's happened in the last few years that shifted to the Overton window, I think that he realizes that, like, there's much more public appetite for left-wing proposals, you know. And but if you're going to say why is, you know, what somebody, you know, how left – you know, how far left are his underlying instincts, right? How far left are, you know, is like what he would ultimately most like to do if he didn't have to worry about all the sort of pragmatic things that a candidate has to worry about before they make a proposal. And I'd say if you're going to compare somebody, you know, like, you know, Bernie Sanders, who started out life politically in the Liberty Union Party in Vermont, with somebody like Elizabeth Warren, who even after her big epiphany after her bankruptcy investigation, you know, when she became a Democrat, was in many ways a much more moderate Democrat, you know, for a long time. There was just a David Brooks column a couple weeks ago in the New York Times where he was bemoaning the fact that in his view, Warren used to be so much more interesting, right? You know, that in the late 90s when she was supporting, you know, charter schools and, you know, all of these things that he likes, you know,
Right. Well, this is, I mean, I don't want to digress and just speechify, but this is one reason why I trust Warren a lot, because, you know, Keynes had a famous line, which is, when the facts change, I change my mind. What do you do, sir? And I feel like Warren, I trust someone who started out kind of on the wrong side of things and then with no real prompting and with no real political benefit to it, came to change her mind drastically about what needed to be done. That is, for me, that's not a sign of duplicitousness or of opportunism, because it really didn't. I mean, she could have run as a centrist Dem, you know, Hillary Clinton type. Instead, that is a sign of trustworthiness, because it means that someone's going based on what they think is needed for the country and is good for the country. But I realize that other people may interpret it as opportunism. Or whatever.
So I'd make a distinction there. I think that what you just said is very plausible with regards to Elizabeth Warren's initial big shift, right? You know, the road to Damascus moment about bankruptcy, where she stops being a Republican and, you know, right, becomes a liberal Democrat. I think with regard to that shift, what you said is very plausible. I've always thought it was silly for people to hold against her the fact that she used to be a Republican. You know, if nothing else, that seems like a counterproductive thing to do, because I'd like to send, you know, I think it would be better to send message to people who are currently Republicans, that if they change their mind, our message is going to be welcome, brother, not what took you so long. But I think it's much less plausible when it comes to more recent shifts, like in the last, you know, basically, I think that, like, anything where she's made a big political shift since about, you know, 2011, right, I think is more
the recession.
Well, not since the recession, right? You know, that was 2008, but I mean, like, since she became a senator, say, right? You know, that they have a, whichever, you know.
At that point, political calculus becomes more important.
Yeah, at that point, political calculus becomes more important. And so I think at that point, and look, this is not like a moral condemnation even. It's not like, oh, you know, she's sneaky, she's lying, right? You know, it's just that if you're going to have some sort of realistic calculus with any politician where you say, okay, you know, if somebody is going to if you really want to know what somebody's going to prioritize when they're governing, you should probably put more weight on the things that they were saying that they've been saying for a longer time than the things that they've like only come around to in the last 6 months or, you know, even in the last, you know, year and a half. And I'm perfectly fine with applying that to Sanders too, you know, that they have, you know, that the things that I think that I have the most trust that he would really invest political capital on are the things that he has been talking about for the longest, like Medicare for all. I agree.
Yeah. I think if he gets elected president, I still think he has a very good shot at winning the nomination. I have three even odds dinner bets on him. So,
Come on,
Bernie. but anyway, no, he has a really good shot. And I think that if he does get elected, there will be a major transformation of our healthcare system. Maybe not exactly the Medicare for all system he envisions. Maybe there'll be negotiations and bargaining, but it'll be different. It'll be national health insurance of some sort. I think we'll get it anyway. And that would be good. It's the biggest pain point in our economy. So like, I'm not going to stay up at nights dreading a Sanders presidency. Here's a question.
Sure.
And you know, I'd elect Sanders over Biden or, you know, or like Buttigieg or some crap. Anyway,
I'm still, by the way, since I'm originally from East Lansing, Michigan, and like I'm every time I think about the existence of Buttigieg in the debate stage, I'm confused, and like it just strikes me anew that it's kind of funny that the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, for some reason, you know, as presidential candidate, like once he ran, he was taken seriously. I don't understand why, like, you know, the mayors of every other city in Indiana and Michigan, and, you know, didn't all throw in their hat too. Or if you're like a provost of a university, it's like, you know, hey, give it a shot, right? You know, but anyway, I digress. So,
you
prefer Sanders to the centrists, but.
Yeah, although I like he wouldn't be my second choice. I'd say Castro would be my second choice.
Okay, interesting. Yeah,
I liked Inslee too before he left. Anyway, that aside, here's a question: do you think that the DSA could become an alternative party that ultimately replaces the Democrats if Bernie loses and if a DSA supported or socialist candidate doesn't manage to break through in the next couple cycles? Do you think the DSA could become a new party, the way the Republicans once subsumed like the Whigs, or the, you know, the Whigs subsumed the Federalists or something like that? Could we see the Democrats go away and a socialist party rise to replace them?
I think that is a long shot. I think that it's not impossible that you could get some sort of reshuffling of the political parties, but I don't think it could start with. I mean, whatever. I mean, so much would have to change in the next couple of years, I think, for that, you know, next few cycles, you said, for that to become realistically possible, because I think that in when the Republicans replaced the Whigs, like, I think that even though there was, you know, in the loose sense, a two-party system back then, I think so much has happened since then to solidify it. And to make it hard to break out of I think the American left got really burned quite badly, you know, by what happened with the sort of Nader Green Party experiment, you know, at the very beginning of the 2000s. That, you know, it'd be very difficult for things to change such that you're going to have an appetite for that, right? You know, I think that what you could have is the DSA or some constellation of forces that includes the DSA or whatever in some new form. I think becoming more of a party within a party. So in other words, that, you know, that could maybe become more of a party in the European sense of like an organization that's kind of holding that, like, the candidates that it produces are sort of held to a certain platform and everything in a way that they're not really here. So that there could be, you know, maybe more like accountability for office holders to sort of toe the line. I could see that happening. In fact, I'd kind of like that to happen, but I don't, But I mean, I would love for that to be true. But I'm deeply pessimistic about the idea of the United States losing its you know, I hate the word duopoly. That sounds so, you know, like
duopoly.
That, you know, that's
I sound, like it. Let's go with so duopoly. Goofy, but they economics. Have any, economics. You know? All right. So here's the question.
I'm really hard to have Bernie
loses. What happens if Bernie loses?
What happens if Bernie loses? Who's he losing to? You mean he
nomination?
Okay, if he loses the nomination, then I think that's a tragedy, because I think the Bernie 2020 campaign represents a once in a generation opportunity to advance social democratic and ultimately socialist politics. I think it's going to be very.
What does the whole movement do? What does the Rose movement do?
Yeah. So like I said, it would definitely be a tragedy, because I think that you're not going to. I think if Bernie wins, as you say, that really shifts. If he wins the nomination, then becomes president, then I think on any version of that scenario, I think that shifts the political terrain enough that you will have Bernie-like figures who can make like a real stab at the presidency in the future. Yeah. But if he loses. Then he himself is eventually going to get, you know, too old to run for president, right? You know, that like I would the bench is not great, you know, for people with Bernie style politics.
Right. It's AOC. She's the next, right?
Yeah, yeah. And she's nowhere near, you know, like
she's young.
Yeah,
no, she could run in what, 2024?
Is it 2024?
Or no, 2028. She'll be old enough to run.
Okay, yeah, one of those. So
you have to be 35 to run.
Yeah.
So 2028. So in 2024, maybe there's nobody, and then you wait for AOC in 2028.
Yeah. I think that would be like a really tragic historic missed opportunity. I don't think that's I don't think it's the end of everything, of course.
Despite the dinner bets, I think that Bernie has about a 1 in 3 chance of winning this thing.
Yeah. That sounds about right. And by the way, I keep saying that and saying that louder, because I think that's exactly the right thing to say to inspire Bernie supporters to go all out. That, you know, 1 in 3 is enough. That's not like some like crazy long shot. That, you know,
it's not a long shot.
You know, but like it's also like, oh, he's probably going to lose. You really better get out there to make sure that he wins.
I don't know, and at least I get 3 dinners, you know, and America gets some health care if he does win. Huh? All right. So anyway, I think this is a good stopping place for our debate, which went over 2 hours. And it was fun.
Yeah. No, I enjoyed it.
Thanks, man. All right. Well, I'll catch you on the internet.
Absolutely.
Before you go, a quick message from the suits at Blogging Heads TV. Blogging Heads will always be free for you to watch and listen to, and we don't even go the NPR route of guilting you into donating during Pledge Week. But we do have a small request. If you enjoy Blogging Heads programming, rate and review us on iTunes. The iTunes algorithm weighs positive reviews heavily, so taking a few minutes to rate and review us will help more people find out about our shows. Also, of course, we encourage you to subscribe to our Twitter and Facebook feeds. Thank you.